Hi Simon, welcome at AirHacks FM.
Well, very happy to be here.
Okay, what was your first computer?
My very first personal computer was what was called a TRS-80 or Trash 80. It was a 16 kilobyte machine.
Okay.
That ran BASIC.
Okay, this is actually a very popular computer in US. And what was your first unpersonal computer? Because this was
yes. So the first computer that I actually wrote a program on would have been a mainframe that was owned by a local insurance company. Because the school that I went to, this was a long time ago. This was back in the 1970s. They actually had a relationship with the insurance company, and so in our school we had a punched card machine. So we would actually go to this little room and we would type in Algol 68 programs on punch cards. And then we'd send them off to the insurance company in a big tray. And then they'd run it through their mainframe. And then we'd get back a big stack of paper, the 132 column Fabfold paper. And we'd see where we'd put a syntax error on our card.
So you started with mainframe and then moved to trash?
Yes.
That's interesting. That's an interesting story. So usually I ask, what was your first action on the computer? But on the mainframe, I assume there were no games, right?
No, we wrote our own. We actually played battleships on this. And it was the weirdest thing because, of course, the kind of return time on this was that each week we would send off a tray of cards. And then the following week you get back the results of those cards going through the mainframe. So it was a 1 week turnaround for every time you wanted to make a move.
Yeah, almost like ChatGPT, but a little bit slower.
A lot slower.
Exactly. Where was it? Was it in the US?
No. This was in the UK.
Okay, cool.
And the reason I had a TRS-80 was because my dad was, funnily enough, he was a complete tech guy who loved all things technical. And he decided that he wanted to get a personal computer. Like I say, this was, I think, 1978. So there was no such thing as an IBM PC at that time or even a personal computer as we know it. So he found this thing called a TRS-80. And he paid an absolute fortune for it when you consider what it actually had inside it. But it was great. I loved it.
And why not ZX Spectrum? Was too early for ZX?
Oh, way too early for that, yeah.
Okay. No, I understand. Because usually all people from UK, they usually have ZX. And
Yeah, I had a ZX81, which was 1981, and that had a 1 kilobyte of memory.
Yeah, this is what I'm wondering. So your trash had more RAM than ZX?
That's right. Yep. And then I moved on pretty much because I had this ZX81, which I didn't like because it had so little memory and it was horrible. And then, again, my dad decided we needed to upgrade our machine. And so he bought a BBC Micro. And that was brilliant because that had color because the Trash 80 was monochrome. So the BBC Micro had color.
And is the BB Micro, was it better than ZX Spectrum?
Difficult to say. I think the Spectrum was probably a little better in terms of power and so on. I mean, the BBC had 32K of RAM, which gave it a bit more sort of space. But then, again, my dad being my dad, he also bought the dual floppy drive with a second processor and extra memory. And so we kind of bumped it up.
Yeah, cool dad, actually. Was he a programmer?
No, he was actually he did chemistry of all things, but he worked in a lab where he had a PDP-8 in his lab. I went and saw that a few times.
Actually, cool story. And you played games or were you more into programming? So you started coding or programming, or what is the story behind?
Yeah, I mean, I started off with all the sort of usual things of like Hello World. And then writing.
Was there wait a second? But back then there was no Hello World, right? Was the idea of Hello World already available?
No, I wouldn't have said Hello World. What you did is you wrote your first basic program, which was like print Hello Simon, and then it prints it out on the screen, and then you put it in a loop, and you go print Hello Simon 10 times, and you go, wow, look.
I have actually to investigate when Hello World started. You know that?
I don't.
Who did it?
Yeah, I don't actually, because I'm thinking that was that kind of, for me, it dates it back to the C programming language.
Okay.
Which would be sort of late, well, I mean, the C programming language dates back to the late 60s, doesn't it? Early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it was around that time.
Yeah. I assume maybe it was in a book or something, like the very first program. Because what I remember, someone wrote on a blackboard, "Hello world." And I saw this and I asked, "Why are you doing this? What does it mean actually?" And he don't know it. It's like, "No, why?" And it's like, "Yeah, because if you write a computer program, the first thing you do is hello world." It's like, "Why?" You know, this is for me. So why are you doing this? So, and this was, of course, after the 70s, since then, I'm wondering that there was one, you know, a period of time where Hello World was actually not that known than today. Mm. Today, everyone knows Hello World, actually. Uh-huh. So what fascinated you? What you wanted to achieve with computers? You started to, why you started coding and not playing games?
I think it was I just had this sort of like fascination of controlling things.
Uh-huh.
And that was something that I always wanted to try and achieve with those very early computers.
Uh-huh.
Because I, even from an even younger age than that, I had a sort of fascination with robotics. And I wanted to build a robot.
Uh-huh.
And I thought programming would allow me to control a robot.
Uh-huh.
So that was my sort of goal for learning how to program, was the idea that I could potentially have a robot and control it.
Which movie inspired you?
That's a tricky one, actually. I don't really remember any one movie that I think of that...
with robots, I assume.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really remember. I mean, No, I can't think of one in particular that
But you like science fiction, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Uh-huh. Pretty cool. So what was your first program? A little bit more interesting, so beyond Hello World.
Ooh. I'm not really sure. I mean, I do remember writing quite early on some very simple sort of card games, because card games were sort of fairly easy to do, because you're dealing with a, you know, nice simple set of things, and you don't even need graphics, so you can do cards represented by text quite easily. So I do remember writing some backgammon and not backgammon, but patience type game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, with the BBC Micro, I assume?
Yes. Also, I was quite interested, again, with the graphics, so I started doing things like creating fractal patterns.
They were very popular. Also very fascinating. Lots of math there, right?
Yes.
Fractals and Mandelbrot.
Mandelbrot set.
Mandelbrot, yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I found an article in Scientific American, again, way back in the day, and I thought, oh, yes, I want to code this up in BASIC. And so I wrote a BBC Micro program to generate fractals. And I tried pushing it to the sort of like nth degree. And I ended up running the program overnight to try and get this really cool Mandelbrot set graphics thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up the next day and I came down and it had crashed because I'd exceeded the stack limit.
Okay. And you use also Logo?
No.
No. Okay, so you were advanced user. Because the typical logos was the turtle, where where you could draw things on the screen, like go there and go there.
No, I did BASIC. Mm-hmm. And then the next language after BASIC, I guess, really would have been C, because that's when I started working in industry. Went to university as well, because I did what was called a sponsored degree. So I did 6 months at university, and then I worked in industry for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And the company that I worked for, they had a system that they were developing for office automation in C.
Mm-hmm. In C. So you moved from BASIC straight to C.
Yes, pretty much.
And how you learned that? I mean, this is tough, right?
Yeah, I was lucky. Like I say, the company that I worked for, they understood that being a student, you spent 6 months at university, so you weren't going to know a whole lot. So they basically sent me on a C programming course, and then worked with people in the department that I was in, and just picked it up gradually like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you like that?
So, oh yes.
Okay. What you did in leisure with programming or nothing? So what was the situation back then?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I do remember even then when I was learning to program in C, that I started working on a program to play chess, because that kind of fascinated me. And again, didn't need to be too graphics oriented, because back in these days that we were using 9600 baud terminals, mm-hmm. like a VT100 type mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm. And it worked, your chess game program?
I got it to the point where you could actually play a game. I never got to the point where it would play autonomously. So mm-hmm. I could have the idea of a board and, you know, you could play against somebody else, mm-hmm. but not having the computer play against you.
Okay, so this was like a simulation of the board without any algorithms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because chess also fascinated me, how it is possible back then that it works at all. So for me, for me, and I know that back then people tried like a tree-like structure, right? Where they knew which, and they tried to score the moves, all possible mm-hmm. moves, and this was the idea. But still, it was unbelievable back then that on mm-hmm. small, because there was almost no abstractions. You had to implement everything from scratch. You know, this was the problem.
Mm-hmm. Real programming.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Real programming means, can you keep everything in your head, or you start with abstractions early, right? So this is, mm-hmm. are you forced, you know, to write like procedural logic, or you could implement a kind of a tree and then forget how tree is working and then use the tree to implement an algorithm. And this is like, you know, the abstractions layer. So this is, today I try, you know, to remember as little as possible and try to abstract as much as possible, right? But back then was a different story. So this was completely different.
Yeah, and that's a good point, you see, because if you think about how people learn to program now, there is mm-hmm. so much abstraction mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. away from the machine. Mm-hmm. And I think that even if you look at how they teach computer science now, because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. although my son's not doing computer science at university, some of his friends are, and I talk to them. And they are doing things at a much higher abstraction than mm-hmm. when I was at university. So they don't learn about the details of how operating systems work and compilers and things like that. It's much more focused on how you apply technologies.
Exactly my case. So I had also classes about how real-time operating systems are working mm-hmm. and operating systems. And I remember Motorola 68000 assembler. I liked that because the professor was great, but back then I was really interested in programming and less interested in the lower stuff. I found it somehow not applicable. That's the problem, you know. And with the programming, I could immediately do something with it. So this was the thing.
It's interesting because for me, I actually found that very low level stuff really quite fascinating. And mm-hmm. You talk about the 68000 processor. That was definitely one of my favorite ones, because we had a machine in this company I worked for that we were developing on, and it had a nice flat memory model mm-hmm. Compared to the Intel mm-hmm. way of doing things. So Intel had this idea of near pointers and far pointers, and that didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I like just a flat memory model.
And but, you could actually use assembler to do something on the machine, right?
Yes.
Yeah, for me it was, I remember I had to use a kind of a simulator on Intel to work with it. So this was pointless, because at the end it worked, but why? Because I didn't have, and I had to have Mac, I think. Mac had 68000 back then or whatever.
That's right,
so, yeah.
Early Macs.
Yeah, and Atari as well, right? No?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Yeah, the ST or the bigger ones.
Yeah. But that's how I actually got to my second job, was because this first company that I worked for, very small company that doesn't exist anymore, aside from developing this office automation, word processing, spreadsheet type software, mm-hmm. they also had a Unix source code license, because mm-hmm. somebody at some point had decided that they needed one of these things. So they bought a Unix source code license, which meant I actually got to look inside Unix mm-hmm. and find out how it worked from the inside.
From whom did they bought the license, you know?
AT&T.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the home of Unix. Mm-hmm. And that's, like I said, that's how I got my second job, because...
Question. Was it only one license of Unix, or were there multiple licensees? You know, it was like AT&T was the master of Unix, or were the other... Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So AT&T owned Unix and licensed it to other people. So anybody who wanted to use it for their machines, mm-hmm. they would license it to people like HP or Sequent or whoever, the DEC, if you remember them.
Yeah.
So they would license it to them. And as I say, because this wasn't open source in those days, I got access to the source code, and I could actually see, you know, how the memory system worked and how the scheduler worked and stuff like that. And that's how I ended up working at AT&T in the Unix part of Bell Labs.
I remember drama in 90s or 2000s was STO Unix or some kind of, right? There was a company who did something with the Unix. They were like, what was it?
Okay, so I can tell you this story.
Okay, cool.
So what happened was, so AT&T owned Unix. So it was developed as part of Bell Labs back in the late 1960s, early 70s. So Ken Thompson, Dennis Ritchie, and so on developed this. And then in, let me see, it would be 1993, AT&T sold the Unix software division to Novell. Do you remember Novell?
Netware.
That's right. So they sold Unix to Novell, which is how I ended up at Novell for a couple of years.
Wow, you were at Novell. So you know NDS, Novell Directory Service, and stuff like that?
Yeah, I never did any of that because I was the Unix side of things.
Okay.
So I ended up doing Unix at Novell. It was called UnixWare. And so it was NetWare. They called it UnixWare. And that's how I ended up in Utah for like 4 months.
Wow. Okay.
But then after a couple of years, they couldn't make a success of that. And they just lost interest in it. So they sold the rights to Unix to SCO. So SCO ended up owning the intellectual property of Unix. And that's when later on, because they still couldn't make a business out of it, and they became basically an IP troll company.
Who
got bought out by somebody who said, oh, yes, we'll take the intellectual property and then we'll try and use that to leverage people into paying us for the IP that's included in that.
Okay, this was the story, because I remember this is why I asked you about the license, what was going on. Okay. Fascinating story. So you end up with, so you had the AT&T source code, exactly.
Yeah.
And what you did with it? So I interrupted you, sorry.
Yeah, so I actually ended up doing things like device drivers for Ethernet cards and things like that. I did a
with disk, the source code, right? Based on the source, yeah.
I also modified, I fixed some bugs in the Unix kernel back in the day. And
incredible.
I should like another story. Again, the company that I worked for, the very first company I worked for, the machine that we had had the Unix source code on it. So what I would do is I'd build the kernel, and we were running a database system, and there was a memory leak. And the memory leak was actually in the kernel, not in the database. And I ended up debugging this. But the way I had to debug it was by putting, there was no such thing as a simple, you know, like debugger that you could plug in and probe into stuff. So you basically put print statements in. And what I would do is I'd put some print statements into the kernel, build it, which would take about half an hour or so. Then I'd have to write it onto half-inch mag tape, put that on a half-inch mag tape thing. Then I'd have to walk across the building to the other machine, which was the test machine, put the mag tape in, load it up, run the program, which took about 2 minutes, see where the memory leak happened, where my print statements came out with the details, and then go, okay, now I need to know this. Walk back to the other place, rebuild the kernel, put it back on mag tape. It took me 2 weeks to find this bug.
It's almost like a microservice communication, you know. Yeah. 2 weeks. And 2 weeks is not bad, actually.
Yeah, it would have probably taken me about an hour, hour and a half.
Without walking.
And where I could have just, you know, rebuilt.
But yeah, but then you could participate in a marathon, right? So this was after the 2 weeks, so you are fit enough to participate. And this was your work assignment. So the company sold machines or the drivers or what?
It sold machines.
What's the name of the machines?
So as I say, this company doesn't exist anymore. It was called Rock Computers.
It was cool name, Rock.
ROCC. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think they called it the Teleputer. Was one of the machines that they made.
Rock is back in the game again, right? This is what Nvidia bought almost. So the IP. This was not.
No. This was.
No. Again, but it's a similar name. This is what I'm
saying. Similar name.
Yeah. There are two names, right? One is from Elon Musk. Is the AI? I think it's also called Rock, right?
I think so. Yeah. But this was ROCC.
Yeah, and it says ROQ, and there is one with C, I think, and this is the A6 where you can run. Okay. Yeah, and this is what they bought, and yours was SCC. So there are three ROGs right now. So interesting. Uh-huh. Yeah, and what happens afterwards? So after ROG.
Oh, that's when I went to AT&T.
So okay. Went to AT&T?
Yeah.
Okay. How it happened? You just applied or they asked?
I kind of contacted a recruitment agent because I was looking for a new job, and he said, "Oh, we've got this role at AT&T. Are you interested?" And I was like, "Crazy. Yes."
Yeah, this is what's like, you know, AT&T, I imagine, with the Unix licensing is almost like some microsystems, right? Later.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It was the home of Unix.
And how was it? I mean, was it like better than expected, worse than expected, or what was the impression of AT&T back then? Or what you did there?
I'd say it was better than I expected. I had an enormous amount of fun working there because, again, getting exposure to all these different technologies and things like that. I did the work that I was employed to do initially was quite peripheral because it was localization of Unix. So making it work with European languages and European keyboards and things like that. So, I was quite a junior role at that time, very junior role at that time. So it was more kind of grunt work than exciting.
As junior, you found a memory leak with lots of walking. So this was actually incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm already curious what happens if you became a senior. And okay, but so AT&T sold they own Unix distribution?
Yes. So they had Unix System 5 Release 4 was the one that they had.
Uh-huh. So this is true, like a Red Hat model, right? They had a source code for the base thing and they had like secret sauce, and this was the okay, very early. When was it?
So this would have been 19. I joined in 1989.
Uh huh. Okay. So interesting. And how long you stay at
AT&T? So that was 4 years. So 1989 to 1994. Yeah, just over 4 years. And then, as I say, Novell bought the Unix part from AT&T. So I got transferred to Novell and ended up there for 2 years. And then when Novell sold Unix to SCO, I decided I'd had enough of doing that. And I thought, I'm going to look around for another company that might be doing something interesting with Unix. And I found this little company called Sun Microsystems.
That's cool, because we almost met, I would say, because in 1997, this was one of the first e-commerce project with Java for me. And I don't know why, but a company, I know why. In Germany, Novell NetWare was very popular back then because of printer management.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for some SMEs or small businesses, and they use Novell for management of everything. So this NetWare. And because Novell could do IP, and I think Windows couldn't back then. This was one of the reasons. And there was Lotus Notes on Novell, which was very popular back then.
Yes.
And I like Novell because of the colors and design. But I couldn't... I actually installed Novell on my Intel machine and it worked, the operating system. I had... Yeah. Yeah, sorry?
Well, I was going to say, because it's interesting, because people forget about this, because you made a good point there, which was that they had IP, as in TCP IP.
Yeah.
And back in those days, you didn't get a networking stack with the operating system.
No.
So the early versions of Windows didn't come with TCP IP. There was no networking in them.
Yeah.
You had to buy it as a separate thing, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And now we implemented an e-commerce solution with JDK 1.1. So, and we use Java Web Server for it and from Sun. So this was the first release. And now crazy stuff happened because for unknown reasons, one of the companies in Germany pinged Novell, and Novell was interested in our solution.
Mm.
And what I remember, Eric Schmidt was CTO of Novell back then, and he was also interested in our solution. And but we were like, no, two guys. And this is why I used Novell to run Java on it. And I used the we had to integrate with Novell directory services, and we had to use the NDS strings, which were terrible. It was like a string, but it was really hard to use. So I was really ashamed back then because, like, hey, he knows Java, and I couldn't just use a string because I remember it was not very... The string was not like a Java string. It was a crazy string. I have to look it up what it was, but I couldn't understand the string. And without the strings, I couldn't implement anything. But at the end of the day, we implemented we integrated Novell. And I was even in Novell conferences back then, but it was like maybe 1 or 2 years later, right?
Okay. That was, I remember the Novell conferences. They're called BrainShare.
Yeah. I even have a VHS. I won a VHS tape. with training, and what I also remember is at the conference, Novell advertised that the BA Tenga is the application server runs really well on Novell. So there was like, you know, the first application servers, Java applications were able to run on Novell, and this is why I look up Tenga. I was like, why Tenga with H? And this was neighbor island of Java. This is why the name Tenga came from. And yeah, crazy. But you left Novell in 1994, you said, right?
I joined Sun in 1996. So I started working at Novell officially beginning of 1994, and I stuck it out for 2 years.
Okay.
And then at the beginning of 1996. So I'm actually approaching 30 years since I joined Sun Microsystems. So it'll be next month, it'll be 30 years since I joined Sun Microsystems.
Yeah. And I think Novell won... 1 year later. And Novell was also at the systems conference in Munich, which was huge. And we had to implement a demo at the conference. So we got the server and everything. And it worked, actually. This was my... And I was fascinated by Novell because it was like... Not magic. It was like mysterious for me. Why someone needs something like this, you know? And this was like... nice design, everything red, complete different look and feel. And it was the same appealing as Oracle back then. Was also fascinated by the Oracle database, similar. And of course, Sun, which Java came out. So I was like, okay, this is really cool. Mm-hmm. And Sun Microsystems. So how you switched from, you applied again?
Yes. Yeah, so I actually, because I knew some of the people I worked with at AT&T and also Novell had moved to Sun. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of reached out to them and I said, look, I'm looking for another job. You got any ideas? And they came back and said, oh, yeah, we got a role here for an SE, so a sales engineer working on Solaris, which is the Sun version of Unix at the time. Mm-hmm. And so since I had all the Unix experience, I interviewed with them and they said, yep, come along and work on Solaris. So I joined them and did about a year of Solaris, and because that was 1996, so Java had been released in 95. Mm-hmm. And I could see that Java was going to be something quite interesting and quite exciting. Mm-hmm. So I thought, right, time for me to change to doing Java rather than Solaris.
Mm-hmm. But you like Solaris at the beginning?
Yes. Yeah? Yes.
I was fascinated by look and feel. What I really liked back then is the CDE.
CDE. Yes.
CDE. And this was really hard to achieve on Linux. So I try everything, but it never looked like CDE. So this is what I wanted to have, you know. I remember like 4 buttons, right, in the bottom where you can switch the screen. So this was, I was fascinated by the...
Yeah, I'm trying to think because there was CDE, Common Desktop Environment.
Exactly.
And then was it OpenLook was the other one?
Lots of them. And KDE was the KDE, close, yes. Later, right? But I had lots of Windows Manager, crazy ones or whatever, but nothing looked like this. You could even buy commercial window managers on Linux, but I didn't did that. But so I tried SUSE, and I tried, you know, Red Hat. This is why I tried also Red Hat early on, because I hoped there would be better window management, and I tried Linux, you know, the entire time.
It's funny all the things you remember when you start talking about this stuff, because there was a thing called, I don't know if you remember this, Laffy Appy, the look and feel independent API.
I remember because XEarth, of course, right? So XEarth and XEyes, and this was what you started on Linux, the first. And this was crazy times because there were text files where you have to create, you know, where you have to configure the resolution and stuff like
that. Oh, yes. The whole environment.
And this was dangerous, actually, because if you misconfigured a thing, either you damaged, even you could damage your machine, or you never saw a window again. So,
yes.
Yeah. Pretty cool. So what you did with Java, I was not aware that you were so early involved with Java. So
So the first bit that I did with Java was as part of my SE role. Mm-hmm. They wanted me to do some talks on Java. So, I mean, I knew nothing about it. So I, you know, picked up a book, read it, and became an instant expert on the basics of Java. So I did...
David Flanagan's book?
Say again?
David Flanagan's book?
No, it was the Core Java book.
Core Java. This was a half book, half Java doc, right?
Yes. So I did a couple of presentations on that. And then I thought to myself, I need to get a bit more actual programming experience if I'm going to use Java seriously. So I changed job within Sun and I joined one of the internal organizations, which was actually using Java to write applications for business applications to be used by Sun. So that like their sales and marketing applications and things like that. And I learned enormous amount as part of that, mostly how not to use Java, because it was, you know, these were the very early days. It was the Wild West of Java programming, and people had some crazy ideas about what they thought.
Yeah, one idea or the one project, I forgot the name of, this was a Sun project, was to create Office in Java.
Mm.
I forgot, it was a nice name. You remember the name?
No, because I'm thinking OpenOffice, but it wasn't.
No. It was from scratch. This was a project where they tried to pure Java Office or something. Mm. And and it was in US or UK?
UK.
UK. Everything you work at? ATM.
Yeah, I've always worked in the UK, even though most of the time I worked for American companies.
That's cool, actually. I thought, you were in Silicon Valley or whatever, but okay. And... So
I did that for about 18 months, learned a lot about how to program in Java and how not to program in Java. And then I switched to working for a different part of Sun, which was what they called market development engineering. And that was working with ISVs, doing performance tuning for Java applications, because, of course, late 90s performance was a big thing. Mm-hmm. So I worked with people like Oracle, Lotus, Infomix, if you remember them.
Yeah.
Basically helping them to tune their Java environments to run their applications as best possible.
Was it like Sun Java Competence Center or something?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. Yeah.
Because I, from time to time, I delivered courses for Sun Microsystems. And I remember there was one guy from SAP who attended my course. And we had a chat, and he was like in such an organization who was just interested in high-performance Java, or from Oracle, maybe. SAP or Oracle. Now, I know. Oracle, which was Oracle database for SAP or something like this. And they also were also interested in Java. So he was the performance expert about that. You also learned a lot there, right? I mean, this was like crazy. So
yes, I learned a lot there. Yeah, definitely. And then that led to when I moved to what was called the Java Technology Evangelist team. And that was then when things got really fun, because
who were your colleagues back then?
So I worked for a guy called Reggie Hutchison. He was my direct manager, and then there was Matt Thompson.
Reggie was the guy who looked like a baseball
That's
player.
Yep. He was a
huge guy, right? So
yes,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so Reggie was my direct manager, and then he reported to Matt Thompson, and so we did a lot of stuff. In just traveling the world, talking about Java. We had the Sun Tech Days, which was a conference that we
also in Frankfurt.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did it in many different places, and I had just so much fun, because not only did we get to travel around and do all these sort of talks, one of the things that he really wanted us to focus on was building demos using Java. And so I just came up with the craziest ideas I could possibly come up with is how can you apply Java to different things? And this is where it came back to that sort of very early idea of, can I build a robot?
And what you did back then, so some of the demos, and which year was it? It was like early...
So this would have been 2000. I started there in 2001. So again, literally this just this month, would have been 25 years since I started working as a Java technology evangelist. I think the one of the craziest demos I did was where I built a robot using Lego. And it was a blackjack dealing robot. So you could play blackjack against this Lego robot. And I would go to work in the morning and I would sit at my desk surrounded by Lego and start building this robot. And I used the Lego Mindstorms controllers, which had somebody had created a very minimal Java implementation that ran on these Lego Mindstorms. Mm-hmm. So I used those to control the motors and the sensors and things. And then I had a laptop which sort of ran the whole software. Mm-hmm. And that had, I used Sphinx, which was the...
Speech.
Speech recognition system. Yeah, that's right. So I used Sphinx as speech
recognition. And FreeTTS was the other way around.
TTS, used that as well. And then I used JMF, which was the Java Media Framework. Mm-hmm. And I connected a webcam, because there was a Lego webcam you could get, connected that. So that when the blackjack dealer was dealing a card, it would actually take a picture of it and recognize the card so that as it dealt the card, it would know what the hands were that were being dealt. And then it could use the voice recognition. You could say, hit or stick.
This is crazy.
I was amazed that I actually managed to get it to work.
And it worked, really?
Yep.
And people couldn't believe that they thought it was a fake, right?
I don't think they thought it was a fake, but it was definitely something that was quite entertaining to people to see that, you could build a robot out of Lego and program it in Java.
And you were also Java 1 with that, or?
Yes. Yeah, I did that. I think that was 2004 might have been when I took that to Java 1. Mm-hmm.
I think I never saw you at Java 1. This is crazy. I met you later with the application server. So, but this days, why not? So I can't remember I ever saw you at conference because I was at some tech days in Frankfurt frequently, but I think maybe it was later, 2005 maybe. Java 1, my first one was in 2000, actually.
Okay.
And this is, okay. So you've worked for Reggie. I had to interact with Reggie. He was a fun guy, actually. But I remember he looked like, a pro sport,
basketball player,
or American football, something like this. So, and he was a fun guy. So, you were just with Reggie and with Matt Thompson back then.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, for nearly 10 years, I had the same manager, which is just incredible. So I reported to Reggie from 2001 until Oracle acquired Sun in 2010.
Okay. And you work as an evangelist all the time?
Yep.
Because I remember the first time we met is because of Glassfish. I did something with Glassfish?
Yes, because of course we focused on all the different aspects of Java. So whether it was Java Micro Edition, Java Standard Edition, Java Enterprise Edition, Glassfish, the tooling, the application servers, everything. So we got to play with all of that kind of stuff. So yes, Glassfish, which is kind of interesting the way that this has come full circle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Forgot about that. So we can talk later about the acquisition, which is interesting. But why I ask about your colleagues, because back then there was also NetBeans evangelist team.
Yes,
at the same time. So, there was Roman Strobel. There was one guy
Hirchen.
Who...
Hirchen.
Yeah, Hirchen. Vilenga is still there, right?
Yeah, he is with Azul.
Azul, exactly. Hirchen, Roman Strobel, two women. I forgot names. They were also involved in NetBeans.
I remember Roman, definitely.
Roman and also the team was larger. There were there were two also.
Because Sharath was involved in NetBeans as well.
Mm-hmm. Sharath Chanda. Mm-hmm.
John Ceccarelli.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's also at Azul.
Yeah, Azul is a new son. No.
Yes.
Yeah, already the impression. Okay. And how you? I mean, Glassfish. You just picked Glassfish and did the demo, or what was the relation to Glassfish back then? Or
again, because we were trying to push the whole sort of Sun software stack. So mm-hmm. when Glassfish came out, then mm-hmm. it was like, okay, build some demos, you know, make things work, talk about Glassfish as an application server. Mm-hmm. So that's how we kind of got onto that.
Yeah, and I use Glassfish outside of Sun, of course, for my clients, and I like Glassfish a lot because it was the reference implementation. Mm-hmm. You could buy support for it, and this was for me a big deal. And for unknown reasons, not many clients knew about that. So if I mentioned that, we always got Glassfish. So I would say in every project, I was always able to introduce Glassfish, which was a huge selling point. And I told this to Sun Microsystems, but somehow they were not that interested in this. It's like, look, this is a crazy. And I actually sold. I never worked for Sun Microsystems. I sold more Glassfishes than Sun itself, I would say, back then in Europe.
Quite likely, yeah. You see, Sun was I loved working for Sun.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic company to work for. So much kind of cool technology, so many mm-hmm. cool people to work with. Mm-hmm. But they just, they focused too much on the technology and they just didn't know how to turn it into money.
Mm-hmm. The funniest story is I was freelancing Sun trainer, so I never worked as a contractor. I worked as a contractor for Sun, but not directly as an employee. And there were the Sun workstations, the Ultra, and I wanted to have one. So I look, I would like to buy the machine. And they look at me, they were shocked. They say, okay, we have no idea. It's like, how? I mean, I'm in this Sun headquarters in Germany. Like, I will pay you. I don't, just give me the machine. And they told me, they have to think about this and they have no idea. Maybe they will call me back, whatever, and nothing happened. And another story is, I was a trainer and companies asked me, can you help us? And I said, okay. But I was hired, the assignment was from Sun Microsystems. So I delivered a training architecture, whatever, for a company in Germany. And then they asked me about consulting. So I go, to be fair, I went back to Sun and I say, hey, Sun, they asked me about consulting. Maybe it would be fair if you do this and you hire me. And they say, no, we don't do consulting. We just do training. Just go ahead and do this. It's like, really? So yeah, no problem. We just do training. We are not. I'm like, but this is a big deal for you. You could get an we just do training. So, okay. So I got lots of consulting gigs because Sun was not interested in this. Everything was set up, right? So, and then I worked directly for the companies and I never understood this. But this changed. If Oracle acquired Sun, there was OOP and they were the first Intel workstations. Mm-hmm. So I asked again, could I buy this? Of course, right? So this was, I still remember, it was like 2,000 euros, whatever. I could buy the machine and it was not that expensive. And it looked great. This was like, this was the first Intel workstations, and they look a little bit similar to the cheese grater in Mac, you know, the workstations.
Oh, so, yes.
Yeah, so yeah. This was similar look and feel. So this was really look really nice.
Ah, yes, I remember them. Yes, now I know the machines that you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. So you spent the entire time until the Oracle acquisition at Sun Microsystems. And you enjoyed the entire time?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, towards the end, it got a little bit frustrating at times because, you know, we were sort of on a downward slope.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're not making money, things are always a bit tight in terms of, like, you know, travel and budgets and stuff like that. And you don't get pay rises for a long time. And then there's continually rounds of rifts with people being laid off. And it's, you know, it gets a bit wearing after a while.
And Oracle took off? What was it? Was it a change, a sudden change, or was it like gradual change?
It was a sudden change.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because I remember, I can remember specifically, you know, opening an email in April of 2009
mm-hmm.
saying, you know, from Jonathan Schwartz, who was the CEO at
the exactly.
time. And he said, yes, you know, we've just entered into an agreement with Oracle to be acquired by them. And it's like, oh, okay.
Okay.
And then in February of 2010, when the deal actually happened, I woke up in the morning and I thought, right, okay, let's see what's happened. And I went on to the HR system and I thought, right, who am I reporting to now? And literally everybody above me, so that was Reggie, Matt, his boss, all the way up to Jonathan Schwartz, had disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I was literally reporting to a number.
Okay. And what happened with Reggie? Was still at Oracle?
Oh, he went off to do all sorts of different things. He's worked for, because I still stay in touch with him. I saw him a couple of months ago when I was in California. And yeah, he's worked for Microsoft. He's worked for Nokia. He's been at VMware. He's been at, I'm trying to think of, I think he was, at, or he may be at Nvidia now. So he's worked for a whole bunch of different companies.
Yeah, cool. Cool story. And for you, something changed except reporting, or you did still your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it took a while to settle down because obviously with Oracle taking over and a lot of changes happening, it did take a while for things to settle down. But, you know, I have to sort of hand it to Oracle that I think they did a good job of taking on Java specifically, maybe not the rest of Sun, but Java. And they have done a fantastic job of being the steward and actually maintaining the development through the OpenJDK. Mm-hmm. People like Brian Gertz, people like Mark Reinhold, John Rose, and Stuart Marks, and all the people who are involved in that. I think they're doing an absolutely fantastic job of maintaining that development of Java. The switch to 6-month release cycle has been very, very good. It's really helped to keep things moving along quickly. You know, we've got things like Project Amber, Project Loom, Panama, Valhalla, which we'll hopefully see this year, things like that. So yeah, they've done a fantastic job.
So I would say there's actually nothing to criticize, right? So it is way better than expected.
Yes.
So from my outside perspective, I was really surprised how well it went, because also interesting, Oracle also got Solaris, and what I planned back then is to use Open Solaris. So I wanted to use Open Solaris for containers.
Yes.
But I remember I waited for the next release and it didn't came out. And there was some like drama. There was some last blog post and whatever. And then it became obvious it will never come out. Mm. And this was actually why I used Docker. And it was one of the earliest Docker users, because what I wanted Open Solaris or Docker for is to document my server. So the idea was on the server is nothing, but the one Docker container with all the configuration, and I can build it in my machine and ship it to the server. And I wanted to use Solaris for it, but it stopped. So this is actually why Open Solaris was discontinued. This was the reason why I switched to Docker, which at the beginning was very unstable. So nothing was stable there. But yeah. So how long you worked for Oracle?
So Oracle I worked for 5 years. So
okay.
2010 through end of 2015. Mm-hmm. And that's when, so yeah, it was good for most of that time. Mm-hmm. It was the last year, 2015, where things got a little bit kind of weird because Oracle had a change in terms of their sort of focus. This is when they switched to very much focusing on the cloud because that was you know, the big thing at the time. And internally, that had quite a big impact on what I was doing because, I can remember it was January of 2015 and I got a phone call from my boss at the time on a Saturday afternoon. And he said, oh, you know, we've just been told that we're going to switch away from doing Java and we're going to focus on doing cloud. And I thought, okay, so you want me to do, you know, go from 20 something years of doing Java to suddenly talking about cloud, which I don't really know anything about. And so we had sort of various discussions internally about this. And again, it's a funny story. I remember being in Japan and I met up with the new sort of VP of the group that we were going to be working in. And we were at a meeting and he said, oh, so you're the guys who are going to help us, you know, make a success of cloud. And I sort of looked at him and went, yeah, not really. And we had this long conversation about what was going to happen. And it became very clear that I wasn't going to be happy about this. And afterwards, I was walking back to the hotel with Stephen Chin. You remember Stephen Chin?
Yeah. Stephen Chin did crazy stuff with Java VX first. Then he started Visage with open source. And then he had the craziest Java 1 demos. He created, you know, like a rack full of Raspberry Pis and brewery or whatever. So he was really involved in Java 1s.
So I was walking back to the hotel with him and he looked at me and he said, I've never seen that before. I've never seen somebody commit career suicide right in front of my eyes. So, that didn't go down too well. And so
was the Japanese guy the...
Oh, no, he wasn't Japanese. He was American. He just happened to be in Japan at the same time.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, that became apparent that I wasn't really very keen on the idea of doing cloud evangelism rather than Java evangelism. So about 3 months later, I think it was October. No, September it was. Yeah, September, that's right. I was on vacation, checked my email, as I do, because I'm on vacation, so why not check my work email? And I saw that there was a message from my boss's boss saying, need to talk to you tomorrow. And it would have been about 2 o'clock in the afternoon for me. And I thought, hang on, why does my boss's boss want to talk to me at 6 o'clock in the morning, California time? Mm-hmm. And I said to my wife, I said, I think I'm going to get laid off tomorrow. And lo and behold, yep, got laid off.
Oh, and what was the, and why?
It was just that they decided that, because it wasn't just me, so it wasn't my negativity that was the whole thing. They laid off pretty much the whole team that I worked with. The only person who survived, I think, was Gerrit, because he worked in Germany. And, of course, as you know, getting laid off in Germany is very difficult. So they kept him on for a while, and then he left. And funnily enough, he's...
Gerrit Grunewald, Han Solo.
Zorna. Yes. And he's at Azorna.
Also at Azorna, of course. But also funny story, because I don't know how much later, but way later, I was in Berlin, and there was still Sun Microsystems building after Sun... Oracle acquired Sun because of Germany. Wow. So, and I was there in the building, and it was fully functional. So there was no Sun logos. Everything was there, like a Sun Microsystems. And I remember I took some picture and posted on Twitter, and no one could believe. It's like, this is what you are doing here. No, there's no more Sun. It's like, of course, I'm in the building. You know, I was also in the headquarters in Sun Microsystems in Germany way after, I think it was 1 or 2 years later. So it's like, and there was still Sun buildings with Sun logos, everything Sun. You could get, you know, swag, Sun swag, because they just give it away. But it was a strange situation.
It did take a while, because I remember that the Sun office that we had in the UK, that was probably about 18 months after the deal closed, before they actually closed that office and we ended up moving into the Oracle offices. But the Sun office was open for quite a while. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what happened after Oracle?
So then I joined Azul. I'd already started looking around for a job before that. So when I got laid off, it was no big sort of like shock. And so I'd actually just sent a random email to Azul saying, I see that you do Java. I'm kind of interested in Java. Have you got any jobs? Mm-hmm. And so I ended up having a conversation with Gil.
Yeah.
And that turned into... I think my first conversation with Gil was 3.5 hours long.
Gil, he was on the podcast, and my conversation with him was even longer. So Gil is amazing, I would say. This is it cannot be even, I don't know whether he is a good boss or not that good. I think he's a fun boss. Whether it is good, I don't know, because you can talk with him for hours about technology and maybe forget about business, you know. Exactly. Gil is a fun guy, really. This is and crazy smart as well.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, he every time I talk to him and we discuss technical things, and he'll just, you know, you sort of ask him a question about something, especially like with the JVM, and he'll go, oh, yeah. And it's like, you know, he'll sort of delve right down into the weeds of how the JVM works. Mm-hmm. And he knows so much about just how Java works.
Mm-hmm. And since then you are at Azul?
Yes. 10 years.
Straight. I would say this is a similar experience like back then to AT&T, right? Because Azul, I would say this is like cutting edge Java or cutting edge JVM, not even Java. I mean, this is everything which is operations, performance, and you did the crack and lots of actually cool stuff. And I always liked Azul because of the Vega systems, which you discussed with Gil. So this is where Azul impressed me the very first time, because of like a Java host system.
Mm. Listen. Yeah, it has been a bit like working at Sun, because, as you say, although Java is still a part of Oracle and they kind of maintain the overall control of it, we do a lot of interesting stuff around that in terms of the high performance JVM, the, you know, Platform Prime with different garbage collection, different JIT compilation, all the other stuff we've done with Cloud Native Compiler and stuff like that, and Crack, as you say, which is also very cool.
Mm-hmm. Listen, what I would like to do is to reinvite you back as often you like, because and cover just Azul. So I don't care whether it's proprietary or not, but just the Java features from Azul, maybe we always can start with a standard and then added value on top of Azul, because this is what I think is a little bit missing, because there's an added value from commercial providers. And if you have, you see the clean distinction, okay, you get Azul OpenJDK this, but if you buy something, you get this. And this is always interesting to hear, because, you know, we had already chatted with Garrett about inventory. This is crazy useful, for instance, right? So that you get code coverage for free if you run it. As just to know, you know, what the interesting features are, because it's really interesting for the Java ecosystem. So,
yeah, I mean, that'd be great. Yeah, we could.
Yeah, we do this. And where people can find you on the internet?
I'm on Blue Sky. That's probably the best place to find me for Java kind of related stuff. So,
and your name is Simon Ritter, right?
My name is Simon Ritter, but my handle on Blue Sky is speakjava.bsky.social.
You were always Speak Java, actually.
Yes.
All your handles is what I remember exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I came up with that as a Twitter handle.
Yeah.
Back in, like, you know, many, many years ago when I joined Twitter. And I needed something that seemed appropriate. And I went through a whole range of different things that were related to Java. Mm-hmm. And obviously many of them were taken already. So I came up with Speak Java.
Very good. Thank you. And see you next time with Java on Azul.
Thank you very much.